Chapter 10. In which the heroine has a number more lovers, and cuts a very dashing figure in the world. 2 years have elapsed since the festival at Richmond, which, begun so peaceably, ended in such general uproar. Morgiana never could be brought to pardon Wolsey's red hair, nor to help laughing at Eglanton's disasters, nor could the two gentlemen be reconciled to one another. Wolsey, indeed, sent a challenge to the perfumer, to meet him with pistols, which the latter declined, saying, justly, that tradesmen had no business with such weapons. On this the tailor proposed to meet him with coats off, and have it out like men, in the presence of their friends of the Idney Club. The perfumer said he would be party to no such vulgar transaction, on which Wolsey, exasperated, made an oath that he would tweak the perfumer's nose so surely as he ever entered the club room, and thus one member of the Idneys was compelled to vacate his armchair. Wolsey himself attended every meeting regularly, but he did not evince that gaiety and good humor which render men's company agreeable in clubs. On arriving, he would order the boy to tell him when that scoundrel Eglanton came, and, hanging up his hat on the peg, would scowl round the room, and tuck up his sleeves very high, and stretch, and shake his fingers and wrists, as if getting them ready for that pull of the nose which he intended to bestow upon his rival. So prepared, he would sit down and smoke his pipe quite silently, glaring at all, and jumping up, and hitching up his coat sleeves, when anyone entered the room. The Idneys did not like this behavior. Clinker ceased to come. Bustard, the poulterer, ceased to come. As for Snaffle, he also disappeared, for Wolsey wished to make him answerable for the misbehavior of Eglanton, and proposed to him the duel which the latter had declined. So Snaffle went. Presently they all went, except the tailor and Trestle, who lived down the street, and these two would sit, and puck their tobacco, one on each side of Crump, the landlord, as silent as Indian chiefs in a wigwam. There grew to be more and more room for poor old Crump in his chair and in his clothes. The Idneys were gone, and why should he remain? One Saturday he did not come down to preside at the club, as he still fondly called it, and the Saturday following Trestle had made a coffin for him, and Wolsey, with the undertaker by his side, followed to the grave the father of the Idneys. Mrs. Crump was now alone in the world. How alone? Says some innocent and respected reader. Ah! My dear sir, do you know so little of human nature as not to be aware that, 1 week after the Richmond affair, Morgiana married Captain Walker? That did she privately, of course, and, after the ceremony, came tripping back to her parents, as young people do in plays, and said, "Forgive me, dear Pa and Ma, I'm married, and here is my husband the Captain." Papa and Mama did forgive her, as why shouldn't they? And Papa paid over her fortune to her, which she carried home delighted to the Captain. This happened several months before the demise of old Crump, and Mrs. Captain Walker was on the continent with her Howard, when that melancholy event took place. Hence Mrs. Crump's loneliness and unprotected condition. Morgiana had not latterly seen much of the old people. How could she, moving in her exalted sphere, receive at her genteel new residence in the Edgware Road the old publican and his wife? Being, then, alone in the world, Mrs. Crump could not abear, she said, to live in the house, whereas he had been so respected and happy. So she sold the goodwill of the youth Jack, and, with the money arising from this sale and her own private fortune, being able to muster some £60 per annum, retired to the neighborhood of her dear old Adler's Wells, where she boarded with one of Mrs. Searle's 40 pupils. Her heart was broken, she said. But, nevertheless, about 9 months after Mr. Crump's death, the wallflowers, nasturtiums, polyanthuses, and convolvuluses began to blossom under her bonnet as usual. In a year she was dressed quite as fine as ever, and now never missed E. Wells, or some other place of entertainment, one single night, but was as regular as the box keeper. Nay, she was a buxom widow still, and an old flame of hers, Fisk, so celebrated as Pantaloon in Grimaldi's time, but now doing the evil fathers at E. Wells, proposed to her to exchange her name for his. But this proposal the worthy widow declined altogether. To say truth, she was exceedingly proud of her daughter, Mrs. Captain Walker. They did not see each other much at first, but every now and then Mrs. Crump would pay a visit to the folks in Connaught Square, and on the days when the captain's lady called in the City Road, there was not a single official at E. Wells, from the first tragedian down to the call boy, who was not made aware of the fact. It has been said that Morgina carried home her fortune in her own reticule, and, smiling, placed the money in her husband's lap, and hence the reader may imagine, who knows Mr. Walker, to be an extremely selfish fellow, that a great scene of anger must have taken place, and many coarse oaths and epithets of abuse must have come from him, when he found that £500 was all that his wife had, although he had expected 5,000 with her. But, to say the truth, Walker was at this time almost in love with his handsome, rosy, good-humored, simple wife. They had made a fortnight's tour, during which they had been exceedingly happy, and there was something so frank and touching in the way in which the kind creature flung her all into his lap, saluting him with a hearty embrace at the same time, and wishing that it were 1,000,000,000,000,000,000 times more, so that her darling Howard might enjoy it, that the man would have been a ruffian indeed could he have found it in his heart to be angry with her. And so he kissed her in return, and patted her on the shining ringlets, and then counted over the notes with rather a disconsolate air, and ended by locking them up in his portfolio. In fact, she had never deceived him. Eglantine had, and he in return had out-tricked Eglantine, and so warm were his affections for Morgina at this time that, upon my word and honor, I don't think he repented of his bargain. Besides, £500 in crisp banknotes was a sum of money such as the captain was not in the habit of handling every day. A dashing, sanguine fellow, he fancied there was no end to it, and already thought of a dozen ways by which it should increase and multiply into a plum. Woe is me! Has not many a simple soul examined 5 new £100 notes in this way, and calculated their powers of duration and multiplication? This subject, however, is too painful to be dwelt on. Let us hear what Walker did with his money. Why, he furnished the house in the Edgware Road before mentioned. He ordered a handsome service of plate. He sported a phaeton and two ponies. He kept a couple of smart maids, and a groom footboy in fact. He mounted just such a neat unpretending gentleman-like establishment as becomes a respectable young couple on their outset in life. "I've sown my wild oats," he would say to his acquaintances. "A few years since, perhaps, I would have longed to cut a dash, but now prudence is the word, and I've settled every farthing of Mrs. Walker's 15,000 on herself." And the best proof that the world had confidence in him is the fact that for the articles of plate, equipage, and furniture, which have been mentioned as being in his possession, he did not pay one single shilling, and so prudent was he, that but for turnpikes, postage stamps, and king's taxes, he hardly had occasion to change a £5 note of his wife's fortune. To tell the truth, Mr. Walker had determined to make his fortune. And what is easier in London? Is not the share market open to all? Do not Spanish and Colombian bonds rise and fall? For what are companies invented, but to place thousands in the pockets of shareholders and directors? Into these commercial pursuits the gallant captain now plunged with great energy, and made some brilliant hits at first starting, and bought and sold so opportunely, that his name began to rise in the city as a capitalist, and might be seen in the printed list of directors of many excellent and philanthropic schemes, of which there is never any lack in London. Business to the amount of thousands was done at his agency. Shares of vast value were bought and sold under his management. How poor Mr. Eglanton used to hate him and envy him. As from the door of his emporium the firm was Eglanton and Mazras now, he saw the captain daily arrive in his pony phaeton, and heard of the start he had taken in life. The only regret Mrs. Walker had, was that she did not enjoy enough of her husband's society. His business called him away all day. His business, too, obliged him to leave her of evenings very frequently alone. Whilst he always in pursuit of business, was dining with his great friends at the club, and drinking claret and champagne to the same end. She was a perfectly good-natured and simple soul, never made him a single reproach. But when he could pass an evening at home with her she was delighted, and when he could drive with her in the park she was happy for a week after. On these occasions, and in the fullness of her heart, she would drive to her mother, and tell her story. Howard drove with me in the park yesterday, Mama, and Howard has promised to take me to the opera, and so forth. And that evening the manager, Mr. Galler, the first tragedian, Mrs. Searle and her 40 pupils, all the box keepers, bonnet women, nay, the ginger beer girls themselves at T. Wells, knew that Captain and Mrs. Walker were at Kensington Gardens, or were to have the Marchioness of Billingsgate's box at the opera. One night, oh joy of joys! Mrs. Captain Walker appeared in a private box at T. Wells. That's she with the black ringlets and cashmere shawl, smelling bottle, and black velvet gown, and bird of paradise in her hat. Goodness gracious! How they all acted at her, Galler and all, and how happy Mrs. Crump was. She kissed her daughter between all the acts, she nodded to all her friends on the stage, in the slips, or in the real water. She introduced her daughter, Mrs. Captain Walker, to the box opener. And Melville Delamere the first comic, Canterfield the tyrant, and Jonathan I the celebrated Fontarabian statuesque, were all on the steps, and shouted for Mrs. Captain Walker's carriage, and waved their hats, and bowed as the little pony phaeton drove away. Walker, in his mustaches, had come in at the end of the play, and was not a little gratified by the compliments paid to himself and lady. Among the other articles of luxury with which the captain furnished his house we must not omit to mention an extremely grand piano, which occupied four-fifths of Mrs. Walker's little back drawing room, and at which she was in the habit of practicing continually. All day and all night during Walker's absences, and these occurred all night and all day, you might hear the whole street might hear the voice of the lady at number 23 gurgling, and shaking, and quavering, as ladies do when they practice. The street did not approve of the continuance of the noise, but neighbors are difficult to please, and what would Morgina have had to do if she had ceased to sing? It would be hard to lock a blackbird in a cage, and prevent him from singing too. And so Walker's blackbird, in the snug little cage in the Edgware Road, sang and was not unhappy. After the pair had been married for about a year, the omnibus that passes both by Mrs. Crump's house near T. Wells, and by Mrs. Walker's street off the Edgware Road, brought up the former named lady almost every day to her daughter. She came when the captain had gone to his business. She stayed to a 2 o'clock dinner with Morgina. She drove with her in the pony carriage round the park, but she never stopped later than 6. Had she not to go to the play at 7? And, besides, the captain might come home with some of his great friends, and he always swore and grumbled much if he found his mother-in-law on the premises. As for Morgina, she was one of those women who encourage despotism in husbands. What the husband says must be right, because he says it. What he orders, must be obeyed tremblingly. Mrs. Walker gave up her entire reason to her lord. Why was it? Before marriage he had been an independent little person, as he had far more brains than her Howard. I think it must have been his mustaches that frightened her, and caused in her this humility. Selfish husbands have this advantage in maintaining with easy-minded wives a rigid and inflexible behavior, viz. that if they do by any chance grant a little favor, the ladies receive it with such transports of gratitude as they would never think of showing to a lord and master who was accustomed to give them everything they asked for. And hence, when Captain Walker signified his assent to his wife's prayer that she should take a singing master, she thought his generosity almost divine, and fell upon her mama's neck, when that lady came the next day, and said what a dear adorable angel her Howard was, and what ought she not to do for a man who had taken her from her humble situation, and raised her to be what she was. What she was, poor soul. She was the wife of a swindling parvenu gentleman. She received visits from six ladies of her husband's acquaintances, two attorney's ladies, his bill broker's lady, and one or two more, of whose characters we had best, if you please, say nothing, and she thought it an honor to be so distinguished. As if Walker had been a Lord Exeter, to marry a humble maiden, or a noble prince, to fall in love with a humble Cinderella, or a majestic Jove, to come down from heaven and woo a Semel. Look through the world, respectable reader, and among your honorable acquaintances, and say if this sort of faith in women is not very frequent. They will believe in their husbands, whatever the latter do. Let John be dull, ugly, vulgar, and a humbug, his Marianne never finds it out. Let him tell his stories ever so many times, there is she always ready with her kind smile. Let him be stingy, she says he is prudent. Let him quarrel with his best friend, she says he is always in the right. Let him be prodigal, she says he is generous, and that his health requires enjoyment. Let him be idle, he must have relaxation, and she will pinch herself and her household, that he may have a guinea for his club. Yes. And every morning, as she wakes, and looks at the face, snoring on the pillow by her side every morning, I say, she blesses that dull ugly countenance, and the dull ugly soul reposing there, and thinks both are something divine. I want to know how it is that women do not find out their husbands to be humbugs? Nature has so provided it, and thanks to her. When last year they were acting the Midsummer Night's Dream, and all the boxes began to roar with great coarse hee-haws at Titania hugging bottoms long, long years to me, considering these things, it seemed that there were 100 other male brutes squatted round about, and treated just as reasonably as Bottom was. Their Titanias lulled them to sleep in their laps, summoned 100 smiling delicate household fairies, to tickle their gross intellects and minister to their vulgar pleasures. And, as the above remarks are only supposed to apply to honest women loving their own lawful spouses, a mercy it is that no wicked puck is in the way to open their eyes, and point out their folly. Cui bono? Let them live on in their deceit. I know two lovely ladies who will read this, and will say it is just very likely, and not see in the least, that it has been written regarding them. Another point of sentiment, and one curious to speculate on. Have you not remarked the immense works of art that women get through? The worsted work sofas, the counterpanes patched or knitted, but these are among the old-fashioned in the country, the bushels of pincushions, the albums they laboriously fill, the tremendous pieces of music they practice, the thousand other fiddle-faddles which occupy the attention of the dear souls. Nay, have we not seen them seated of evenings in a squad or company, Louis employed at the worsted work before mentioned, Eliza at the pincushions, Amelia at card racks or filigree matches, and, in the midst, Theodosia with one of the candles, reading out a novel aloud. Ah! My dear sir, mortal creatures must be very hard put to it for amusement. Be sure of that, when they are forced to gather together in a company, and hear novels read aloud. They only do it, because they can't help it, depend upon it. It is a sad life, a poor pastime. Mr. Dickens, in his American book, tells of the prisoners at the silent prison, how they had ornamented their rooms, some of them with a frightful prettiness and elaboration. Women's fancy work is of this sort often only prison work, done because there was no other exercising ground for their poor little thoughts and fingers. And hence these wonderful pincushions are executed, these counterpanes woven, these sonatas learned. by everything sentimental, when I see two kind, innocent, fresh-cheeked young women go to a piano, and sit down opposite to it upon two chairs piled with more or less music books, according to their convenience, and, so seated, go through a set of double-barreled variations upon this or that tune by Herz or Kalkbrenner, I say, far from receiving any satisfaction at the noise made by the performance, my too susceptible heart is given up entirely to bleeding for the performers. What hours, and weeks, nay, preparatory years of study, has that infernal jig cost them? What sums has Papa paid? What scoldings has Mama administered? Addie Bulblock does not play herself. Sir Thomas. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.